But it doesn't stop there with just being a city on a hill. After Governor Winthrop utters these words about being a city on a hill, just a few years later, the people in the city on a hill move out to massacre the Pequot Indians.
Co-sponsor of Portland Tycho Farm Fest on Sunday, August 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Triskelee Farm in West Lynn. Portland Tycho blends traditional Japanese taiko drumming with dynamic choreography and storytelling. That's Portland Tycho Farm Fest on Sunday, August 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Triskelee Farm, 29700 Southwest Mountain Road in West Lynn. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, will there be a nuclear meltdown in Ukraine? Also, has Governor Newsom sold out the people of California to the nuclear power industry? And we continue our drumbeat frontline coverage of the United Farm Workers Pilgrimage for human and worker rights. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, key nuclear issues in the Ukraine and here in the United States. The threat of nuclear calamity has hung for months over Russia's war in Ukraine. Those fears were renewed last week after shelling intensified around the massive Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, Europe's largest, which has been under Russian control since March. Meanwhile, it seems like the governor of California has gone nuclear crazy, wanting to provide subsidies of over $1 billion for this dying industry, an industry that could kill all of us. So that's what we're going to focus on, nukes here and abroad. And to kick it off, we're joined by Kevin Camps. He's with Beyond Nuclear. Kevin is their radioactive waste specialist for that group. Kevin, welcome to Flashpoints, and Harvey Wasserman, welcome back. Kevin, I want to start with you. Give us the latest. What's your understanding of where the situation is now? We're hearing about fighting. We heard about the Russians telling their workers from the plant to stay home. I'm not sure really what that meant. I don't know how, except they said except for emergency workers. I don't know what that means, but give us a sense of what you're seeing there and what you think the dangers are at this moment.
Yeah, there's been a ratcheting up or a escalation of tensions surrounding the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, as you've said. And one of the indications was that the Russian military decision makers had ordered their Rosatom, that's the Russian state nuclear company officials, who are really in charge of the plant, even though Ukrainian workers are the tacticians carrying out exercises and controlling the plant. But the Russians were told not to show up for work today, and also most of the Ukrainian staff were told not to show up for work today by the Russian military. So only control room operators and essential personnel. So, you know, those kinds of things are very concerning. Both sides are accusing the other of staging a false flag operation that was supposed to happen today. And what form it would take is what's so frightful. Would it be more shelling that did more damage to more vital safety systems? As you mentioned, the radioactive waste at the site alone is dozens or scores of Chernobyls waiting to go up in flames, because these are indoor wet storage pools that are not inside radiological containment. They're in warehouse buildings. So if something as simple as the electricity going out, and most of the power lines are down, they've been severed due to shelling, that's the first line of defense in terms of safety and cooling electricity. The last line of defense then is emergency diesel generators. And those are infamous for not working when they need to. So if those pools boil dry and the fuel is exposed to air, it will be on fire within an hour or two. And this would dwarf Fukushima. This would dwarf Chernobyl. It would be a global catastrophe. And those are the kinds of bluffs being called, this game of chicken going on right now in Ukraine.
Wait. Talk a little bit more about, so the reactor is exposed. It melts down, and there is a nuclear reaction. Is it similar to a weapon? What would it really look like?
Well, the silver lining right now, I guess you could say, is that only two of the six reactors at Zaporizhzhia are operating. Now, just to give folks an idea of the size of Zaporizhzhia, it's six reactors. It's Europe's largest nuclear power plant. I believe it's the third largest nuclear power plant in the world in terms of reactor number. So those two operating reactors are the most in danger of losing cooling and melting down. And then the consequence of that, depending on the circumstances, is most likely to be just massive releases of hazardous radioactivity into the environment. That happened at Chernobyl because of a design flaw, an operator error, and massive explosions and fires that burned for 10 days back in 1986. This time around, it could be due to a missile fired by accident or by intent, or explosive set off by accident or intent. The list goes on. So those two reactors could still melt down. The other four have been shut down for some time, which is good news because they're cooler, they're in a more stable configuration. As long as there's fuel in the cores, things can still go wrong, and I don't know that they've removed the fuel from the core of those other four reactors. But the mother load of hazardous radioactivity at this plant is in the indoor wet storage pools. That's where decades, the first reactor at Zaporizhzhia fired up in the mid-1980s. You've got decades of high-level radioactive waste piled up in these pools. And you've also got high-level radioactive waste in outdoor dry casks. These are cylinders of steel and concrete. And incredibly enough, several times now, going back to March 3rd, March 4th, and then more recently, August 5th and 6th, there's been shelling that has hit the dry cask storage area of the plant. In fact, one of the workers, a security guard, was injured by shrapnel in that area. That's high-level waste, too. And there's been some downplaying by some voices that, oh, that's not such a big deal. Well, it's still a big deal. If one of those dry casks is breached open, you've got high-level radioactive waste strewn about the site. It could be on fire. It could be releasing its contents into the air. The only good news about dry cask storage versus pools is these are discrete units. So unless a bunch of them get blown up at the same time, the pools, though, they could all go up in flames with huge quantities of waste implicated.
Long-term and short-term damage, right? We wouldn't even know how many people are wounded initially. Obviously, they couldn't control the release, so the statistics are unknown, other than we've seen what happened at Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and Harvey Wasserman. What you don't want us to see at Diablo Canyon in San Luis Obispo, but should we be as worried as we are about what's going on in Zaporizhia? How do you see this, Harv, from the you're in the battle against nuclear power here in the United States? Put this together, make the transition, take us from there to here.
It's beyond terrifying, Dennis. This is what Gavin Newsom wants to bring to California, is the kind of thing that's going on in Zaporizhia, and even more so because it's totally out of our control. The two reactors at Diablo Canyon, which are directly upwind from L.A., predominantly, you know, at Fukushima, thankfully, the winds did not blow into Tokyo. If the winds had been blowing into Tokyo at Fukushima, you would have potentially millions of people dead already, among the 15 million in Tokyo. In L.A., which is predominantly a downwind direction from Diablo Canyon, if the San Andreas Fault goes off, which could happen at any moment, or any of the 12 earthquake faults that we know of that are in the immediate vicinity at Diablo Canyon, you could have a meltdown and explosion within a radioactive cloud in downtown Los Angeles or in San Francisco if the wind changes within 5 hours. And the apocalyptic impact of such a radioactive cloud are impossible to calculate. And yet Gavin Newsom wants to keep these reactors open through 2035. People spent 2 years negotiating a very sane and sound shutdown package for Diablo Canyon. And now Gavin Newsom, in 2 weeks, wants to have a vote, in less than 2 weeks, wants to have a vote in the legislature to give Pacific Gas and Electric $1.5 billion from the taxpayers' money to keep these reactors open when we have no idea what could happen. I mean, at least at Zaporizhia, we have people making decisions about what's going to happen there. You have crazy people doing this, but at least we know somebody has to pull the trigger. At Diablo Canyon, which we do not need, the power is completely extraneous and super expensive, and absolutely there's no excuse to continue to operate those plants. It's completely out of our control. There are a dozen earthquake faults at the site. The San Andreas is 45 miles away, which is half the distance from the earthquake that destroyed Fukushima. And Gavin Newsom wants to throw away, stab in the back, all the people that worked on the deal to shut the Diablo Canyon for no reason whatsoever within 2 weeks. It's absolutely obscene, Dennis. And we have got
I can't. The thing, the only thing that I have to question of all that you just said, which is terrifying, is that with for no reason whatsoever, for no reason, for corporate reasons, because he's wanting and thinking about running for president, is it an industry problem? Who owns him on this? Why would he put us all at risk?
Well, for no reason has to do with the public welfare. What Newsom is doing is for his own private benefit. We don't know exactly how, but we know that the nuclear power industry desperately does not want Diablo Canyon to close, partly because the deal that was cut to set Diablo Canyon makes perfect sense. The only thing that doesn't make sense is keeping it operating to 24 and 25, should shut right now. But the bottom line is you have 92 reactors in the United States still operating. The nuclear industry wants to keep every one of them going. The plan to shut the Diablo Canyon is sane. It makes economic sense. It makes ecological sense. It's good for the workers. It's good for the community. And that's exactly why the nuclear industry does not want it to proceed. And at the same time, and what people need to do is call your state senators, call your state reps. I don't even think I'd bother with the governor anymore. He's clearly on the take. And at the same time that they want to keep Diablo Canyon open, they want to shut down rooftop solar. There's proposals in front of the Public Utilities Commission All now right. that would destroy okay. rooftop solar. It's unbelievable.
Okay. Let me. That's Harvey Wasserman. We're talking about nukes here and what's going on in Ukraine about the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which is many plants surrounded by fighting now. Kevin, we often hear that, well, that's over there, and they don't. You know, we have much better nuclear power plants here than they do, and we have much better safety precautions, and we don't face the same kind of problems. We're not in a war. How would you assess the dangers? Do we have much better power plants that are unlikely to melt down?
No, not at all. I mean, hopefully war would never come to the United States, but that can't be ruled out. But I think something that most reasonable
people can
agree is that we have earthquakes, but we also have domestic terrorism threats. So there's already been an instance of the Atomwaffen Division, which is a neo-Nazi group, planning and beginning to attack a plant in Florida called Turkey Point. They were apprehended by police before they got there, but their car was full of weaponry and ammunition. This happened some years ago. And Al-Qaeda on 9/11 was considering attacking the Indian Point nuclear power plant, but higher-ups in Al-Qaeda...
That would be in New York City. That would take out New York City. I just wanted people to know that's just up, down. New York City is downwind from that plant. Go on.
Yeah, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed confirmed with an Al Jazeera reporter before he was captured and sent to Guantanamo that Al-Qaeda had considered it, but they did not want things to get out of hand. That was why they didn't attack Indian Point on 9/11. So we depend on the moral restraint of terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda because our nuclear power plants are sitting ducks. Their security is a joke. Diablo Canyon is the poster child for that. San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, working with attorney Diane Curran of Washington, D.C., challenged the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at Diablo Canyon because there was no security analysis for the proposed 20-year license extension. And they won in federal court in the Ninth Circuit. The court ordered the NRC to do a security review under the National Environmental Policy Act, like they should have been doing for decades thus far. And what they did in response to the court order was a D-minus seventh grade book report. And it didn't do much. And you wish that the court would come back at them and say, this ain't good enough. That didn't happen. But the security is very lacking in the United States. There was a transformer yard attacked by mysterious assailants years ago in California. It tore up this transformer yard, did damage to equipment that takes months to repair. So if that were to happen at a nuclear plant, if the transformer yard at a nuclear plant were to be attacked like that, that's your primary source of electricity for the safety and cooling systems potentially going out. And all you're thrown back on now is the emergency diesel generators, which fail way too often to work when needed. So those are some of the risks in this country. But it can be something as simple as a severe weather, a natural disaster. There's various pathways to meltdown.
Well, you mentioned that attempt at the Florida plant. Now, we have... we're not talking Al-Qaeda here. We're talking a burgeoning, expansive, very violent right-wing movement in the United States that are making all kinds of threats. Some of them aren't that smart, but it doesn't take too much smarts to think about, you know, how if you really want to make trouble, how can you do it? So I wonder if there's, Harv, do you have any idea? Is the United States taking extra security now, given the fact that we've got an expanding white supremacist movement that seems desperate to sort of restrain the vote and install a dictator named Trump?
Yeah, well, you know, it's actually the opposite. Whenever these nuclear plant owners get a chance, they cut expenditures with public safety being casualty number one. We all know how great PG&E is at protecting human life, burning down factory forests. They blew up, a neighborhood in San Bruno. And here we are dependent on them for the security at the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. And ask yourself, you know, there once was a requirement that nuclear power operators provide evacuation planning for in case of an accident ask yourself, where are the evacuation plans for the Bay Area or for Los Angeles or even for the Central Valley when an earthquake or a terrorist takes out Diablo Canyon? You know, there's no such thing. It's not possible. How Gavin Newsom could turn around and take this gamble with all of our lives and our fortunes and our sacred honor for no public benefit whatsoever is truly astounding and unforgivable. So we need to call our state senators and reps and get them to vote against this $1.5 billion package that Newsom has come up with to keep Diablo open. It's absolutely apocalyptic. Think about trying, Dennis, to evacuate L.A. or San Francisco in the face of a radioactive cloud, especially in the middle of an earthquake. You know, Hurricane Andrew in 1991 went right over the Turkey Point reactors that now terrorists have tried to attack. How do you evacuate Florida in the middle of a hurricane with a radioactive cloud? How do you evacuate the Bay Area or L.A. in the middle of an earthquake with a radioactive cloud? These people are gambling with our lives, and it's got to stop. So people need to call the legislature and demand that this bill, this handout, $1.5 billion that Newsom wants to give Diablo Canyon, that's got to be stopped now.
Let's just say, and you're going to have the last word here, Kevin Camp, say you were advising Newsom, I mean, and you want to give him some direct advice. What would you try to tell him to get his attention? What kind of history? What do you need to say to get a politician's attention? Is there any hope?
Yeah, we're facing the same situation here in Michigan where I'm talking to you from, where Democratic Governor Whitmer is trying to get the Palisades atomic reactor shut down for good on May 20th, turned back on with the help of a billion or more in federal taxpayer money, and Diablo's potentially going to go, Newsom's going for that federal money too. So we have tried to communicate with the governor. We've communicated the risk levels. One thing that Palisades and Diablo have in common is they are in the top three worst embrittled reactor pressure vessels in the country. So that's another pathway to meltdown. If the emergency core cooling system is ever activated at either Palisades or Diablo Canyon Unit 1, and that cold water hits that hot metal, because they're trying to prevent a meltdown or an overheating that leads to a meltdown, the vessel will fracture through its wall like a hot glass under cold water, except it's at a ton of pressure per square inch. And once that vessel fractures through wall, the cooling water's lost to steam, and you have a meltdown, and the last line of defense is containment. And we saw how containment performed at Fukushima. It failed and released the contents into the environment. So those are the kinds of risks we're trying to communicate to the governors. And, of course, the positive side that Harvey advocates for so well is the renewables. We don't need Diablo. We don't need Palisades. Renewables and efficiency and conservation are growing by leaps and bounds in this country, blowing away nuclear power economically in terms of competition, blowing away fossil fuels. We don't need these risks. We don't need these.
Well, we're out of time, but it's going to end up blowing us all away if we don't pay attention to what you have been saying, Kevin Camps, working with Beyond Nuclear, where you're a radioactive waste specialist. Harvey Wasserman, people want to know more about what you're involved with. They want to join, lock arms with you and your work. How do they do it?
Write me directly, Solartopia at Gmail. Write me Harvey Wasserman at Solartopia at Gmail. I'll send you a free PDF of my People's Spiral of U.S. History. And Dennis, okay, our lives are on here. People got to call your state reps and state senators and tell them, vote down this $1.5 billion bailout before it kills us all.
All right. Thanks to both of you for joining us on Flashpoints. Please come back and keep us posted. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, KPFA here in the Bay Area. We're going to take a short break. We will be right back. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Berenstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine here every weekday, 5 to 6 Pacific time. And, well, this is a story that, strangely, for today's edition, starts in Tel Aviv, but really takes place in Mexico. You may have heard a former top Mexican official accused of compromising the investigation of a notorious mass abduction has taken refuge in Israel, while the extradition case against him is mired in a diplomatic tussle over Israel's treatment of Palestinians. Well, joining us to talk about this is Camilo Perez Bustillo, and he's executive director of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the NLG. Tell us about who is this guy, what's he doing in Israel, and tell us about the history of what's behind this, the killing of those students in Mexico with government involvement. Camilo?
Dennis, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Please speak up into that phone.
Yes, Dennis. Thank you for the time. And the key thing is this. This Mexican official was in charge of Mexico's equivalent of the FBI during the most crucial moments in the investigation of the mass disappearance of 43 students from the rural teachers' college in Guerrero called Ayotzinapa. People all over the world and throughout the U.S. have mobilized in support of the families of these, the missing Ayotzinapa 43. This has been the single most important human rights case in Mexico in the last 10 years, and one of the most important in Latin America. The question is, why was he given refuge in Israel? Among other activities...
We're talking about Tomas Zerón, correct? We're talking about Tomas Zerón.
This is the former Mexican official who is currently residing in a high-rise in Tel Aviv, protected by an Israeli businessman and millionaire with whom he reached multi-million dollar contracts to sell surveillance spyware from that corporation, from Israel, to the Mexican federal police at the time that he was running that agency. He used that surveillance spyware called Pegasus. This is a story that broke internationally in the last few years, to spy on the students, spy on their parents who've been fighting to try and solve the mystery of their mass disappearance, and to spy on journalists and human rights advocates in Mexico. This is why he fled to Israel. This is why he's being protected there. And the question is, what stake does the Israeli government, does the U.S., which is, of course, its most stalwart ally, have in contributing to the continuing cover-up of this case? The key headline out of all of this is that the Mexican government is seeking Zerón's extradition from Israel, but there is no extradition treaty between Mexico and Israel. So it's completely up to the, quote, goodwill of the Israeli government whether they hand him over. The Mexican government, meanwhile, has been trying to negotiate some kind of deal with Zerón to try and, let's say, reduce the charges against him in return for him testifying about what happened to the students. That's the new breaking story. 24 hours ago, the Mexican Truth Commission focused on this case of the 43 for the first time, officially declared that the disappearance of the students of the 43 in September 2014, when Zerón was heading the Mexican FBI, was a criminal act of the Mexican state, was a state crime. There are 33 different high-level Mexican officials, including Zarang, the guy who's hiding in Israel, who are potentially going to be prosecuted for this case. But interestingly enough, it doesn't include, although it includes every other high-level official at the time, it doesn't include Mexico's president at that time, who was Enrique Peña Nieto, the predecessor of the current president. So it looks like perhaps the current president is covering up for the previous president, in effect. And what it doesn't include is the high-level military commanders who were on the scene, and the Minister of Defense who coordinated the operation, which culminated in these students' disappearance. So
let's remind people, Israel
is part of this bigger story.
And let's remind people that this was in 2014. This was a time of great resistance when the teachers and the students had come together and were protesting in the streets and having a powerful influence beginning to be felt in terms of policy. So you've got Zarun coming in, really essentially acting to shut it down.
So the question is, what did the Israeli government know, and when did they know it? What did the U.S. government, the U.S. embassy in Mexico, which is the largest single U.S. embassy in the world? We know that there have been hundreds of millions of dollars funneled to Mexico for the drug war. We know that this incident in which the 43 students disappeared is a culmination of the drug war. And we also know that the state of Guerrero, where all of this took place, has been a hotbed of resistance to the government, as you mentioned, since the 1970s, where there were armed uprisings led by graduates of this school, of this rural teachers' college, rural guerrilla movements that grew out of those communities. These are also the communities that migrate to New York, that migrate to San Francisco and LA, to Chicago. So Guerrero is sort of the point of convergence of all of these different threads. The other thing is, this announcement comes on the eve of the 12th anniversary of another massacre, the massacre of migrants, many of them from Guerrero, who were killed at a place called San Fernando, an hour and 20 minutes from the U.S.-Mexico border in the state of Tamaulipas, in August 2010. That case and the case of the 43 are the two primary examples of recent state terror in Mexico, subsidized and promoted by the U.S., and now being covered up by Israel.
We are speaking with a good friend of ours, Camila Perez Pasillo, and we're talking about a case in which the former, essentially the Mexican equivalent of the FBI, the head of the Mexican equivalent of the FBI, Tomas Zarón, is now essentially in exile in Israel. The Mexican government wants him back. Apparently, this Truth Commission wants him back. They want to know his role in the disappearance of these students. They also want to know what happened, I guess, in some $50 million in state funds in terms of this guy, Zarón, embezzling. This is another case. So he's like a double criminal. The United States, have they said anything? Any response from Israel, U.S.? Anybody saying why they refuse to return this guy who may have been engaged in this kind of mass murder of these students?
You know, the Israeli government response has simply been, you know, to state the fact, which is there's no extradition treaty between Mexico and Israel that would obligate Israel as to these charges to return him to Mexico unless he agrees to be returned, essentially by becoming a state witness, by becoming a prosecution witness, so in exchange for cooperation. They're trying to see if they can cut some kind of deal, but there's no assurance that that will happen.
It's not going to happen. Not going to happen, and it's because you mentioned, in part, it has to do with Pegasus. People do not realize that one of the things that Israel does and makes a lot of money doing is exporting equipment to repress populations that are resisting or standing up or considering a revolution. Pegasus is a surveillance system. And I cannot see why Israel would want to allow an investigation into Zaron, which would include the use of Pegasus in domestic affairs in Mexico, because the use of Pegasus, it's being used in many countries, Israeli equipment being used to repress populations. They test this stuff on the Palestinians. They demonstrate how effective it is, and then they export it to other countries, say, look what we can do to the Palestinians. You can get this. We'll give it to you cheap.
And essentially what the Israeli government has been doing over the last few days in shutting down 7 Palestinian human rights organizations, raiding their offices, welding shut their doors, that is exactly the kind of use to which they put that spyware like Pegasus, but in countries like Mexico. So they're essentially exporting Israeli terror to countries like Mexico. The bottom line is what we have at this moment is the open collusion and complicity between the Israeli government and the most dangerous sectors, the most terrorist sectors of the Mexican government to try and suppress information about this case. And we can definitely allege, based on that, U.S. knowledge and cooperation as well.
Why, just to get to the heart of the matter, why do you suppose, what was the reason, what would be the justification, or who would benefit from the murder of these 43 students?
You know, they were essentially killed in a drug war operation that went wrong. What happened was the students stumbled, allegedly, on a bus full of drugs that were being trafficked from Guerrero to Chicago by a local drug cartel that controlled the state government and the municipal government in Guerrero, where all of this took place, and that was wired through the military to the national government. So what the national government is trying to shut down is any further investigation that would substantiate those links between what was intended to be supposedly a drug war operation and what is in fact a human rights crime of massive proportions. This story is too big to fit into that drug war narrative. It spills over at the edges, and it's revealing all of the levels of complicity, not just of Israel, but of the U.S. itself. The question again is, what did the embassy know, and when did they know it, and what did the Israeli government know, and when did they know it, and why are they trying to shut down this case and deny justice to the families of these 43 students? Only 3 remains have been found of the 43. The other 40 have simply vanished, and we have hundreds of people in their communities of origin still demanding justice. This was a case that shut down Mexico in 2014 and 2015, kind of like the George Floyd uprising. That would be the analogy. So the faces of these students, the 43, became known throughout the country. And it includes several of their parents who are migrants in the U.S., including Mr. Tizapa, Antonio Tizapa in New York, who's been known as the long-distance runner because he wears his son's image in the New York marathon and so on. So the bottom line is this: the demand for justice continues, and the demand is that this current government of López Obrador hold his predecessor responsible for this cover-up and for the collusion that's involved.
What has the United States commented on at all on this? Have they protested what happened to those students? Have they The United States, we know the United States, if they wanted to have a little influence over Israel, Israel is the number one recipient of U.S. foreign aid, military aid, and otherwise it seems that the United States could say, look, you really should help the Mexicans out. We need to get to the bottom of this, or we'll screw with your aid. Any chance? Any mention?
It's absolutely clear that, you know, if the U.S. wanted to, it would. It hasn't. And if anything, the U.S. is participating in the cover-up, in effect, by failing to demand justice. And so we have to see what happens next in the next few weeks and months. But we know, again, there are 33 high-level officials, including the former commander of the Mexican Armed Forces, who you might remember was arrested by the DEA when he arrived in the U.S. a few months ago, and then mysteriously was sent back, and the charges were dismissed.
And what are the families of the victims saying? Are they active? Are they engaged?
They have not stopped. They have not rested a single day, a single hour. This incident was on September 26th, 2014. The anniversary is coming up, September 26th, you know, a month from now, roughly. And you can bet that they will simply intensify their efforts. Today was the first time that the Mexican government has admitted that this was a government crime, a state crime. That means that there's continuing liability. The current government is as liable as the previous government and the current president as well as the previous president. And they will continue to demand justice for their missing sons.
Well, the current president, didn't this was one of the things that he sort of declared as he rose to power, that he was going to get to the bottom of this and not let things like this continue to happen against people who were taking action in the street. After all, he came to power through great activism, former
and
mayor of
claimed,
Mexico City.
He claims he's lived up to his promises by creating this truth commission, but the question being asked today by the Mexican media and human rights organizations, and most importantly by the parents of the students who were kidnapped and probably killed, the question being asked is, why is the line being drawn at the previous president? Why is the current president refusing to hold his predecessor responsible when his predecessor was commander-in-chief of the military units that it is clear were aware of what was going on with the students, knew about their disappearance, and had in fact infiltrated the group of students? It was admitted in the press conference yesterday that at least one of the students had been infiltrated by the military, was in fact a military service person. So the military knew exactly what was going on, and that means the president knew.
Wow. All right. Well, we're going to stay on this story. We've been on it from the beginning, and we really appreciate your information, Camilla. This is something that you have so much information about. It really helps us. It helps our audience. We've been speaking with Camilla Perez-Bustillo. He is the new executive director for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the NLG. He works with Witness at the Border. There's always more to say, but we're going to have to leave it right there for now. Thanks, Camilla. Hello, be safe.
Please come join us here at the National Lawyers Guild San Francisco Bay Area chapter at 558 Cap Street. And we are here to continue to fight for justice in this case and related cases of human rights in the U.S. and around the world. Thank you, Dennis.
You are so welcome, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are going to take a short break, and then we return to our coverage of the farm worker pilgrimage. Miguel has been out there. He's definitely been on his feet, and we appreciate that. We're going to have a special guest, too. Stay with us. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage, 335-mile pilgrimage for worker rights, for the United Farm Workers who want the rights that other unions have in terms of how to organize and expanded rights to organize. And Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed it once, and thus this pilgrimage to Sacramento to get the governor to pay attention. Today, we're really delighted to be joined by a filmmaker who's been on the walk, Enrique Salcedo. He's a filmmaker, and he has been working on a film about this pilgrimage. Enrique, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us.
I appreciate it.
Tell us about how did you first hear about the United Farm Workers? Have you known about them from the beginning? Tell us why you've decided not only to take the walk, but to film this pilgrimage for worker rights.
Well, I just want to make one thing clear. I'm the supervisor, production manager on the film. The director is Michael Schilf, who brought me on the project last minute, and I was more than happy to join, because I do know about the United Farm Workers. I have family that has worked in the field, and I myself worked in the field as a kid alongside with them. So when I had this opportunity, I jumped right on it, and it was last minute. It was the week before the march. So normally we have more time to prepare for it, but I was game to do it and to march alongside with them as well.
Tell us, for you, what's at the heart of the matter? Why is it important for people to know something about the history of the United Farm Workers and the role they've played? I'm shocked that they're still at this level at the struggle, that they have to walk 335 miles. But tell us, what's at the core for you?
For me personally is knowing the struggle, what they go through, that they're invisible, but we enjoy the fruits of their labor every day, and we don't have a second thought about it. And a lot of these people, the workers, all the workers, they don't get to see their children work up. They sacrifice so much, leave their homes at 3 in the morning, come back at 5 p.m., and, barely have enough time to be with their children. And these are the people that we should be caring about and we should be taking care of.
We had a teacher on yesterday who was also a former child farm worker and grew up with farm workers, and he was talking to us about and he remembered in his own life that how hard it is. He's a math teacher in junior high school, and how the kids are sometimes just so out of it. They're so tired, they're exhausted, they sometimes there isn't enough to eat, and it's a real struggle. I've mentioned this before, but I'm thinking back to Edward R. Murrow in the 60s and the Harvest of Shame, and it does really seem like while some things have changed thanks to the United Farm Workers, the abuse continues, and that the farm workers do not get the same kind of treatment that other workers get and given, despite the fact that they put the food on the table that we all depend upon.
Yes, and I think right now is a pretty important time, because that's going on in a lot of industries as well. So it's bringing attention to this struggle that's been a struggle for many, many, many years. And I think people are realizing how we need to treat people, how do we need to treat workers in general. But most importantly, again, the United Farm Workers, they had to work through COVID. Otherwise, we have no food. They have had to sacrifice their family, their time. And there are farm workers marching out here without pay, with not seeing their families, and sacrificing even more. And I think it'd be great if people can realize that and pay attention and give them a voice and have them be seen.
Can you maybe share a couple of stories of some of the people that your team has met and filmed, and what stands out for you? Specific stories?
Yes, we've it's many, many stories every single day. But there's, you know, it's the workers that, even though they're marching in over 100 degree weather and many, many miles, 22 miles a day sometimes, they still keep their spirits up. They still keep their hopes up. It's very inspiring. But some of the stories, one of them is there was a young man, and he saw the march go by. He had no idea what it was about. He just got inspired, grabbed his things, joined the march. Didn't know where it was going, didn't know when it was ending. He marched all the way from where the point his home was. And at the end, he says, I was sitting at home, not doing nothing. And I got inspired, and now I want to do something. So he joined us one more day. And I wish I would remember his name, but he has now been touched by this. So it's that was an inspiring story for me, for youngsters, to hopefully this will affect them and they will do something for their community, the farm workers, and anybody else that needs help.
Are you surprised at what some call really a brutal decision by the government? He considers himself a liberal progressive. Apparently, he's thinking about running for president. Are you surprised that he's already vetoed this call by the farm workers to be able to organize the way other unions are? Does it surprise you? If you were his advisor and you had a few minutes, what would you tell him about all this?
I'm surprised because the rest of the world gets to do it. The bill is about the farm workers being able to vote in private like everyone else in this world, and they're the only ones that don't have that, to my knowledge. And it's embarrassing. It's not a good look for him, and it's 2022, and we should be living in the future, not in the past.
It is, though, troubling. Have you met any politicians? Have you interviewed any politicians along the way, local, state senators? Have they been a part of this? Have they shown their support?
Yes, there's been local mayors, local council members, state senators, and, you know, and honestly, I just finished a 12-hour day today doing both the march and the filmmaking, and I'm a little fried right now. But we have had a lot of support from, you know, from local politicians, et cetera. And the CHP, the local police, have shown the support and escorted us and all that stuff. So it's been very inspiring.
How long did you walk today?
They walked 17 miles, and I came here to do the film, but when I saw what was going on, and I all of a sudden I became a part of the march. I always planned.
So
to
you
march.
Didn't plan to march at first.
Well, I planned to march. I didn't. Yeah, I came to do the film, and I did plan to march for myself, for my, you know, my family, for the workers. And I was always going to do at least 5 miles, and some days when I was off from the film, to walk the whole march. But now I've decided to help them, and I've been asked by the UFW to help them organize the advanced team and the logistics, and I was more than happy to. So now I'm doing double duty. So I march, I support, I help, I jump back with the film crew, and I jump back with the marchers. So I'm all over the place. So it's become a big, and I don't feel tired. I don't feel, I feel very inspired by these people. You know, watching them when they take breaks and their feet are just blistered, and you know, some of them are just barely walk. But I asked them, can I get your ride? They're like, no, I'm gonna finish this march today. I'm gonna finish this march, and they might be 10 minutes behind, they might be 20 minutes behind, they will finish it, and that is very inspiring.
Wow. Well, listen, we really appreciate you talking to us today. I guess let me just ask you, when did you first hear about the United Farm Workers? How did they come into your life?
Well, I remember I studied it about it. My mother told me about it, about the 1966 march with Cesar Chavez, with the boycott of the uvas, the grapes, and just being around my family and myself working in the fields, I knew about it, and it's always been important to me. And I think over the years, like you, they've had some successes, but they're always in the shadows, in the background. And I think now is the time with social media, with what's going on in our current climate for all workers, that they need to be held in respect and given just basic rights that everybody else has.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us on Flashpoints, and for you being willing to take the walk and to document this. And I'm hoping that the governor might at least consider what's going on there, and maybe he'll think twice about how he wants to act. I want to thank you again for joining us. I want you to be safe, and good luck on the film. Can't wait to see it.
Great. And I want to say, please come join us on the march. If it's for a day, if it's for an hour, if it's for a few minutes, come and be inspired. Have the youngsters come out, and everyone, and you will be inspired by these people and by this march.
Well, we're going to cover it every day on our Flashpoint show, given the support we're getting from Miguel Gavila Molina, who's been walking his toes off.
Yes.
We're very interested in labor rights and in following this march and seeing what the governor does. Thanks for being with us. Stay safe.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, anytime. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I want to ask you, Rod, if you can dig out our Julian Assange song that I wrote with Francisco. We have a few extra minutes. And I just want to remind people that Julian Assange is in very difficult shape. And we believe in the work he's done, as did all the major press that used it to win awards. We don't think it's a great idea to shut down a publisher journalist. It's according to an attorney for the New York Times, if they can do this to Julian Assange, I'm quoting now, it's close to a quote, they can do that to the New York Times or any journalist. So we are very, very concerned about Julian Assange. And I want to see if we can share with you, they're making a film based on a song, an anthem that Francisco Herrera, the great troubadour contributor here to Flashpoints, and I wrote. Francisco wrote the music, I wrote the words, and we worked with some wonderful producers and Cuban musicians to do this anthem for Julian Assange. And since we have a few minutes, let's play a little bit of it for you here. All right, we're going to get that for you in 1 second. Again, want to let you know that we will continue to cover that march until its culmination. We're hoping the governor will act on that. And there's so much more to come. And we're searching to find that song. Maybe we'll just play some other music if we can't find it. right. So I just a little fib. I thought we had that ready, but we don't. But we do have Miguel, and we have 60 seconds, Miguel. How was your day today? Did you do a little walking?
Absolutely, Dennis. We walked 17 miles, and it was about 106 degrees. But the reception in Manteca was unbelievable. I mean, the community is probably, you know, close to 1,000 people. The reception, the food, and all along the route, we were escorted by the Lowrider Car Club Association of the Valley. You know, rather than having the police escort and so forth, they escorted us. It was incredible. And you know, just all day long, Dennis, cars, trucks, everyone. It was like a chorus of constant honking in support of farm workers. And like I said, at the end, it was just an unbelievable reception. You know, this is causing the resurrection of La Causa, something that Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta devoted their lives to. So we will continue this. We walked about 250 miles, and we will continue, and we'll be back reporting live come Monday.
All right, we're out of time. I'm Dennis Bernstein. That's Miguel Gabriel Molina. He's on this 330-mile trek for worker rights for the United Farm Workers. We'll see you next week.